This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, the race for mayor of Boston. The candidates are sharpening their differences, and the latest poll suggests the race has tightened.
Razor-thin margin. It couldn't be closer.
Also this week, students in Danvers struggled to come to terms with the brutal murder of one of their teachers.
She was the kind of teacher that blamed herself if you got a bad grade, and she was always there for us.
And a new report from the city finds widespread abuses among Boston taxicab companies.
There are a lot of problems in the industry, and the management of it has been in constant upheaval.
And the World Series in Boston. The Cardinals give it away in Game 1, and the Red Sox return the favor last night.
Now the runner, Jay, down to third. The throw gets away, and the Cardinals will take the lead.
And they never looked back. We'll dig into those stories in our Week in Review. And joining us now is Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Joan. Great to have you.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
So Joan's sounding a little far away from her microphone, but we'll try to take care of that. And John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. Hey, John, good to have you.
Good to be here. I hope I'm not too close to the microphone.
Never. Not a chance. Well, let's jump right into the race for the mayor of Boston. A number of recent polls suggest the race is very tight, including WBUR's own poll conducted by Mass Inc. It finds City Councilor John Connolly holding on to a very slim 2-point lead over State Rep. Marty Walsh. Here's Mass Inc. pollster Steve Cozzella.
What we have right now is we have two well-known candidates, two very well-liked candidates, and they're picking from slightly different demographic groups and ending up very close. So as we move ahead, the big question is, where do the undecideds go?
Cozzella says Walsh is favored by long-time residents, while Connolly has a sizable lead among more recent arrivals in the city. So obviously, John, get out the vote efforts will make the big difference. And he says, or he asks, where do those undecideds go? So what's your view on where this race stands right now?
I think it's absolutely going to be an organizational race, whoever can turn out. And one of the interesting aspects is the endorsements that that Marty Walsh has gotten from the minority candidates, several of the minority candidates from the preliminary, Charlotte Gola Ritchie, Felix Arroyo, John Barros. Those are good, solid endorsements. Whether they translate into votes is another question. Mm. And I think that that's going to be one of the difficult things for them. You look at the poll, you look at the WBUR poll, both of these guys have 60% favorable ratings. I mean, that's makes it very hard for people to sort of split at the very end of the race to decide who do we want to pick, because there's nobody you'd be voting against. There's only people you'd be voting for. At least it seems that way anyway.
And Joan, I think we've got you back on a working microphone. What's your take on where this very, very close race stands right now?
Well, I think each campaign thinks that it's a really close race. I'm getting feedback on this.
All right, Joan, stand by. We'll come back to you. Let's talk about how the tone of this race is shifting, getting a little angrier maybe. The two candidates debated twice this week. Tuesday night, Marty Walsh was asked about some flyers sent out by outside pro-labor groups that cast John Connolly as a son of privilege. Let's listen.
When I heard that piece went out, I was very upset about it. I immediately put out a statement to the people doing it and asked them to stop. I actually called John. John's my friend, left him a message. And I don't do campaigning like that. I never have. I never will.
And here's how John Connolly responded to that.
Marty has premised his campaign on the notion that because he's a labor leader, he's going to be able to get labor leaders to do things they wouldn't normally do, and that they're going to listen to him. And yet there he is on Saturday saying, stop doing this. Two more pieces of mail today. They're not listening to you now. How are we going to know they'll listen to you when you're actually mayor?
So, Joan Vinocchi, third time lucky. I think you're on a phone now, but are you with us?
I am with you. How can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. So, Joan, what do you make of this back and forth? You wrote thoughtfully this week about how Boston doesn't need a phony class war fueled by labor supporters of Marty Walsh. What's going on here, and what kind of issues is that phony class war obscuring, in your view?
Well, I'm willing to take Marty Walsh at his word, and when he says that he, you know, just doesn't like this and he wishes they weren't doing it, okay, fine. But the labor groups that are doing this are really doing a disservice to him, I think. It's a distraction. It makes it look like he's part of a negative effort against John Connolly, and I do think that it distracts from the larger issue of the difference between rich Boston and poor Boston. There isn't that much class difference between John Connolly and Marty Walsh. They're kind of variations of a theme, and to try to make Connolly's upbringing or parents or the fact that he went to Harvard an issue in this race, I just think it's misguided.
Mm. John, what's your view on this?
You know, Marty Walsh was on the defensive because John Connolly says, look, you know, the unions don't listen to you when you ask them to stop doing this. He was on the defensive. Now this has shifted a little bit because Marty Walsh has come out and said, at least I called for them to stop doing it. John Connolly, who's been accused of having some connection with a push polling firm, which basically does interviews that emphasize the negative about the opponent, he hasn't commented on it, at least last I saw. So Marty Walsh is saying, at least I'm out front about it and I condemn this stuff. He hasn't. So he's trying to gain back the sort of the edge in this particular issue. But I think that it was bound to come to this. The preliminary was a pillow fight, and it's been totally civil up to this point. It actually now sort of feels like an actual Boston mayoral race.
Can I just jump in? I was going to agree with him and say, to get back to that original question, I think this is a sign that the race really is close, that they're sort of nibbling away at the edges here, and they've decided that they've got to, they have high favorability ratings. They don't want to squander that, but they're going to go after each other a little bit now to try to close the gap.
Well, John and Joan, let's move on, if we can, to another major piece of news this week. And that happened in Danvers, because classes resumed today at Danvers High School after the shocking murder earlier this week of Colleen Ritzer, a 24-year-old math teacher at Danvers High. Police found her body in the woods near the school, and one of her students, 14-year-old Philip Chisholm, has been charged with her murder. Here's Rania Radawi, a freshman at Danvers High School and one of Colleen Ritzer's algebra students.
She was the kind of teacher that blamed herself if you got a bad grade, and she was always there for us, always.
And here's what Rania had to say about Philip Chisholm, the 14-year-old who's been charged with Richard's murder.
He was shy, he didn't talk much. He was very smart, he was in honors classes, and he was very nice. It shocks me that nobody would ever think that he would do something like this.
So, Joan, let's start with you. What are your thoughts on this troubling story? I mean, Philip Chisholm has been charged as an adult.
Well, obviously, it is a terrible, horrible, tragic story that nobody ever wants to hear about. I have a 24-year-old son, and you can't help but think about it in the context of just a young life and a promising young woman, and life cut short in a terrible way. Having said that, I mean, I find that charging him as an adult, when he's 14 years old, a very emotional reaction to a horrific crime, understandable, but I'm not sure it's the right road to go down.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the law says you can charge a 14-year-old for first or second degree murder as an adult, but I don't believe you have to. And I think that this is a sort of a quick reaction to just the horrific nature of it. And it's a real head scratcher, because this was not a kid who was a loner. He was popular. He was one of the stars of the soccer team. This is not an alienated kid who all of a sudden came in and started shooting up a school or something. It's very mysterious in a lot of ways. Just exactly why this happened.
Mm. You know, we've been talking a lot about this story in our office here at Radio Boston, because there's so many issues raised by the murder. Of course, the untimely death, the horrible death of a young and very dedicated teacher, and then school security, because apparently the initial assault, at least, probably happened at Danvers High School in the school building. How the other students, the other young people in Danvers are recovering from a trauma like this. But we also started wondering about how reporters covered this story, and you know, the many tragic shootings and deaths and untimely deaths that happen, you know, in Massachusetts all the time that get far less coverage. I mean, Joan, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I was actually thinking about that this morning when I was listening to the news and all the reporters saying that they were live from Danvers High. And, of course, there is something very compelling about the story, the young, promising teacher just starting her career, 14-year-old kid, all the elements that we've discussed. But yeah, I mean, we have raised this issue before, you know, a suburban setting versus a city setting, the violence that happens all the time in Boston streets that we've sort of become numb to, and this very horrible, terrible crime that gets all the spotlight and makes the national news immediately. I guess I make of it of what I look at it and see it for what it is. I mean, it's different. It's news. It should be covered, but there's definitely a brighter spotlight on this kind of news.
John, you do a lot of media criticism and media watching. What's your thoughts on that?
This is what the media does and do. I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the way the system works at this point. That's what sells newspapers. That's what fuels newscasts, and they're going to do it because it's worked for them in the past. And people protest all the time, and rightly so, that this is a gross inequity. But it doesn't really affect the media. They have some, you know, soul-searching conferences in Aspen every once in a while, but basically it doesn't change because that's how the system works. One of the interesting aspects of this, and the Globe pointed this out in an editorial today, is social media providing so much more fuel for the media to use, so much more fodder for them in terms of characterizing people, in terms of tracking people as they've developed. The Twitter, Facebook, all of that gives a sort of a rich source of material to make it even more of a sort of a media overkill.
But it's a rich source of material that, and by virtue of one of the people in the story being dead, is out of context as well, because you can't really like double check what was that person's intent when posting this or that.
But it was all sunny side up stuff, you know. So I mean, if there were a dark side or two sides to it, but there doesn't seem to be yet.
Back in the day, it would take a couple of days to piece together the story that comes out within an hour of a horrific incident like this, right? I mean, you'd be phone calling, you'd be knocking on doors, you'd be trying to find people who knew both people, and that's happening now. But just in the immediate blaze, there's the Facebook stuff, there's Twitter, there's all that information out there that just turns it around so quickly. It really is a different animal.
I'll tell you, as a journalist myself, though, the concern that I have is that in that immediate blaze, as you're saying, Joan, it's easy to sort of cherry pick the aspects of social media that nicely fit into the narrative that you want to say, which may not, as the deeper reporting happens over time, it may or may not conform to that early narrative that emerges in the first 24 hours.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
true.
Absolutely. But who wants to be, what media side wants to take a pass on a story like this? Nobody does. The competition is just fiercer than ever. And it doesn't necessarily lead to better journalism, but it does lead to more news more quickly.
Mm. Well, truly a troubling story. Let's move on and talk very quickly about yesterday's report from the city of Boston that found widespread abuses among Boston taxi cab companies. This came several months after an expose on the city's cab industry by the Boston Globe. Among the findings in yesterday's report, 99% of the city's handicapped accessible vehicles violate federal standards. The city's largest taxi companies routinely ignore rider calls, and it was critical of the city oversight of cab companies. So my question, Joan and John, I'll start with you, John. What happens now? Does this report lead to substantive changes in the city's cab industry?
Luckily, we get a blue ribbon commission, just what we need, another blue ribbon commission. I think that's the first instinct. That you do it, you get a consultant to assess the problem, which is what the city of Boston did, and you get a report, and you say, we're going to appoint a commission to look into this. Commissions are wheel spinning to a large degree. I think that it's interesting. Tom Menino has a terrific reputation in this town, and he has a lot of people wishing him, sending him off in grand style. This sits right on his doorstep, and I think that this has been a chronic problem for so long that that it would be nice to see some accountability somewhere up and down the line. We haven't seen anything like that yet. This is a terrible taxi town. It's just a terrible taxi town. You stand around, and the cabs drive by you because they can't pick you up outside of the city of Boston, those kinds of things. I mean, it's kind of crazy. But anyway, but the abuses in the Globe report are really significant, and they're sort of life-altering for a lot of cab drivers, and I think they really need to be addressed.
Yeah, Joan, I mean, that Globe Spotlight series found that drivers were forced to pay what amounted to tips or bribes to dispatchers to get fares. Does anything in this report address those very serious allegations that you could see?
Well, I haven't read the report, I'll be honest about that, but I mean, my first reaction is, we always had a saying around here, Globe gets action. And I mean, the series the Spotlight team did definitely got a lot of attention, and it's revealed something that people probably knew about in a larger sense, but it just kind of really highlighted details that, that were shocking to people. Whether or not anything happens after the Blue Ribbon Commission, well, that's going to be up to the next mayor. So it'll be interesting to see if it's a priority for whoever wins on November 5th, because what Tom Menino can do between now and January is really limited.
Hmm. All right, well, we've got enough time now just to move on to the big story of the week, and that, of course, is the World Series. Game one, the Red Sox easily thumped the St. Louis Cardinals, who spent the night tripping over themselves and not looking much like a major league team. So it seemed briefly that Boston might be on its way to another sweep. But last night, the Red Sox were brought to earth and played their own version of sloppy ball. Two errors in the seventh inning. Now the series is tied, moves on to St. Louis. So here's Red Sox manager John Farrell.
We've got to continue to play every inning and look to win every inning. This team has responded well to challenges on the road or at home. Now, this time of year, our guys embrace every challenge that comes their way, and we're looking forward to that on Saturday.
So, John, two evenly matched teams, best records in baseball. How do you think this plays out? I'll start with you, John.
Well, first of all, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say I've been an out Yankee fan in Boston for 39 years. So,
all right, enough out of you, Joan.
Exactly. I don't know if anybody wants to hear anything I have to say here or not. I think that it's a really interesting series. It got a lot more interesting last night. That's not the way Red Sox usually lose games. But on the other hand, the way the Cardinals lost in the first, that's not the way they usually lose games either. So I think there may be some opening jitters, and I think it's going to be interesting to settle in. If I could just weigh in one more thing.
Yeah.
The 2-3-2 playoff World Series system is a disgrace. It should be 2-2-1-1-1. I don't know why they're doing 2-3-2. There are Jets now. We have Jets. It works out okay.
John, I got one word.
Yeah.
Baseball. Tradition. That's two words. Tradition.
Tradition was 2-2-1-1-1.
Oh, really? Is that the way they
absolutely
used to do it?
Interesting. Absolutely.
So, Joan, your thoughts on this World Series?
My take on the World Series? Well, here it is. Here are my thoughts. I think for both teams, the theme is redemption. The Cardinals were swept the last time they went up against the Red Sox, mm-hmm. and they've already made sure that's not going to happen to them. I don't know if they're going to prevail in the end, but at least they're not. It's not going to be 0-4 for them. And redemption, obviously, for the Red Sox after last season and all the terrible headlines that came out of that year with, shall I say his name, Bobby Valentine. So I think it'll be interesting to see who prevails. And I think whenever you face real adversity in your profession, no matter what it is, you want to prove the critics wrong. And I think both teams want to show that they can get over the past.
All right. Well, it'll be fun to watch, and Game 3 Saturday night in St. Louis. So let's move on to those our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold. Megna, let me come to you for your hubbub.
Okay, I'm laughing in advance because I hope we have the radio safe version of this queued up. Okay, we do. So here's the beginning part of my hubbub.
Forget New York and California. There's a better place. Now close your eyes. Take my hand. We are almost there. Our favorite place on earth, Massachusetts. It's the 14th biggest state.
Okay, so before you, let me tell you to resist the urge to hold your lighters up above your head. This is a song from a Norwegian group called Ylvis, if I'm saying that correctly. They're a couple of comedians, actually, who not that long ago put out a song called What the Fox Say, which is an acronym for something else we can't put on the radio. But this song about Massachusetts has gotten a lot of negative reaction on social
media.
Yeah,
I wonder why.
And it's dopey. We can't even play the rest of the song because it sort of degenerates into some very unsavory things. But in the Globe, music critic James Reed wrote that the whole song is completely tone deaf, random enough that it doesn't even register with people from here or for that matter who live elsewhere. Well, it turns out that it's probably a song that's actually spoofing American exceptionalism when it comes to the thought that the United States and maybe even particularly Massachusetts might be a paragon of progressivism. So that's a European sort of mocking critique.
A European smackdown.
Yeah, Bay State self-love. Exactly.
Wow. All right. John, your hubba.
So I'm not moving on. I'm going back to the World Series because we may be seeing version 2.0 of Dan Shaughnessy Red Sox jinx. This started back in 2011 when on the last day of the season, during a rain delay, Dan Shaughnessy went on Nesson and said, Tampa Bay's going to lose. They're never coming back from being down 7-0 to the Yankees. And he says, so Shaughnessy says, so the Sox will live on to play in the series or in the postseason. Of course, Tampa Bay did come back. The Sox also lost that night after the rain delay. And all of a sudden, there were all these stories. Did Dan Shaughnessy jinx the Red Sox? There is a Facebook page, Dan Shaughnessy Red Sox jinx. Cut to yesterday, the front page or the Politico playbook, New Daily Digest, has Shaughnessy jinx, ? And refers to his front page piece yesterday, which was, let's say, prematurely triumphant. So we may be seeing this whole thing resurface. Dan Shaughnessy has a lot to answer for.
All right, well, we'll get him on the show and ask him the tough questions.
Yeah, Joan, let him know.
Yeah, Joan, warn him. And what's your hubbub, by the way?
Okay, well, mine isn't as exciting as you guys, but the Globe had a Metro front story today about Harvard announcing a campaign to encourage more low-income students to apply. And that's nice. But the day before, I think, buried inside the paper was a story about Tufts University, which is reaching out to high school students at Medford and Somerville Public Schools and sort of instituting this program where they're going to try to get more local kids to apply to and be admitted to Tufts. They have a Kids to College program that they're going to sort of have an enrichment program for sixth graders and invite ninth graders to see the Tufts campus. And I guess I just would file it under not just warm and wonderful, but doing what I think these institutions of higher learning should be doing, reaching out to lower income kids and showing them the possibilities that exist in their very own neighborhood.
Mm. And by the way, we're going to be tackling, again, the issue of college affordability next week on Radio Boston. So thanks for that, Joan. So here's my hubbub. It's about an increasingly common American speech affectation known as vocal fry. And we're going to talk about what that is in a moment. But here's what prompted a bit of a debate this week. Listen to Sabrina Farhi. NPR introduced her yesterday as the new voice who will identify NPR on all its programs.
And beginning in November, I'll be bringing you NPR's corporate sponsorship credits as NPR's new announcer, such as, support for this program is brought to you by, and just remember, I'm not as serious as I sound. I'm Sabrina Farhi, and this is NPR.
Okay, so that sounds innocuous enough, but as soon as that clip was sent around, the folks at Slate.com began to debate whether Sabrina Farhi has vocal fry. And what that is that sort of staccato thing that you could kind of hear in the back of her throat that is increasingly common among some women, girls in America. And it prompted this discussion on the Slate podcast, Lexicon Valley, with Bob Garfield. Here's a clip from that.
Something happens to their voice. It had a catch in their throat. I have an 11-year-old who does not speak this way, but can.
Ida, be obnoxious.
I was gonna, go to the mall with Jason, but he's so self-centered.
Now, it's not the bop part of it, you know, the kind of loop-the-loops that she did with her inflections there, but it was the in self-centered.
He's so self-centered.
That is exactly the phenomenon I'm trying to describe. And it's annoying. I mean, it's really annoying.
So there it is, really annoying. You can find a link to this debate and discussion on Slate.com at RadioBoston.org and the debate about all of this, and you can decide whether Sabrina Fry has vocal fry. I mean, Sabrina Farhi has vocal fry. Joan Vinnocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Nice to be here, and sorry for the technical problem.
Not your fault. Good to have you back. John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind Campaign Outsider blog. John, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And I just have to say, Bob Garfield, whose work I have an infinite amount of respect for, he's verging on old fart with that.
Hey, get criticism. Off my lawn, you kids.
Angry fist shaking in the air. Well, coming up next, we'll talk to one of the key architects of Massachusetts healthcare law and the early lessons from when Massachusetts health insurance went online and what Obamacare and the troubled government healthcare website can learn. I'm Begna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.